In adolescence, there is an enormous change that happens, not only in people's bodies, but in their minds. They move from being able to think mainly about concrete entities, concrete representations, objects, and people, as they are in very specific terms, to being able to think broadly and abstractly. This begins right around puberty, and it moves on about 15 years until it reaches its full blossoming in early adulthood. So with this emergence and the elaboration and development of abstractions, people come to be able to think about themselves in new, much more general, much more powerful ways, think about how they relate to other people, to their society in these more general ways. And so with the beginnings in adolescence, people come to be able to see themselves in the world in kind of a broad, meaningful framework. So things like ideology and personality become real dynamic parts of a person beginning in adolescence. Today we're going to talk about that. We're going to talk about puberty and then the emergence of abstractions and how abstractions move through a series of levels, how that connects to brain changes, and how it in particular occurs for how we know about things, epistemology, reflective judgment, how we think about ourselves in relationships, and about how this series of reorganizations shows the way that skills emerge successively over levels, not just at one point, but it's a series of points. With reorganization of prior level skills at higher skills. So those are our main points for today. We're starting off talking about puberty. Puberty is one of the most dramatic biological changes that occurs after infancy, with sex hormones creating secondary sex characteristics and the ability to reproduce. There are enormous environmental factors that contribute to the development of puberty, and it's important for us to understand that, both just for understanding puberty in its own terms and for understanding how it relates to the development of abstractions. This is a girl from the Kalahari Desert, something like Gong is the name of her group. They speak a Click language. She's 14. And as you can see, she hasn't started puberty. And in this group, in the Kalahari, that is typical. Puberty comes around 15 or 16, not at 12 or 13 or 11, as it does in most of the industrialized world. In the U.S., the average age of puberty for a girl is 12, at the beginning of puberty. And for a boy, it's about 14. Throughout much of the world, the age of puberty has dropped over the last 100 years by several years. So it's now 12. It used to be 14 or 15, as it still is in the people who live in the Kalahari. The causes of this variation are nutrition, climate, general body fat, and other kinds of characteristics. So when children grow up with better diet, they start puberty earlier. When they live in warmer climates, they start puberty earlier. For girls, there has to be a certain percent body fat for menstruation to begin. Those are three of the factors. There are many others, of course, that contribute to this variability in the onset of puberty. Now, a question for us in looking at cognitive and emotional development is how does puberty relate to these changes? We don't know the answer to that. There have been a few studies of puberty that have shown no relationship between puberty and cognitive developmental changes. In other words, the onset of abstractions or what Piaget called formal operational thinking. There was a problem with those studies. They focused on the gonadal surge of sex hormones, which usually happens at around 11 or 12 for girls in, on average in the U.S., with the first menstruation at 12. It turns out that a couple of years earlier, there's another sex hormone surge that comes from the adrenal gland. So initially, at around 9 or 10, there's a sex hormone surge from the adrenal gland, and then a couple of years later, there's a sex hormone surge from the gonads. So puberty actually has a kind of two-step process. And interestingly, that first hormone surge turns out to be just exactly the time that children start to show their first abstract thinking on average. We don't know that there's a connection, but it's the reasonable hypothesis that there might be. So adrenal sex hormones start to surge at about 9 or 10. At that age, adults, when they're retrospectively reporting when they first started feeling sexually attracted to someone, they reported it at about 9 or 10 years. And that's the same age for boys and girls, whereas for the gonadal hormones, there's a two-year difference on average between boys and girls. And it's the same age for people who end up heterosexual or homosexual, that they report this first sexual attraction at about 9 or 10 years. So there might be a relationship. We really don't know. But adolescence is a time of enormous change, because we've got at least three major changes going on at the same time. First, we have this bodily change with the onset of a more active sexuality with puberty. Then we have the cognitive change with the emergence of abstract thinking. And we have a social change in which people are treated differently by other people and put in different roles in social institutions. They're expected to start acting more like adults, in part because they look more like adults because of puberty. So it's a time of enormous change, really beginning at 9 or 10 with this adrenal sex hormone surge, and then moving into full bloom with the gonadal sex hormone surge at around 12 to 14 for boys, for girls, and boys respectively. Now, the emergence of abstract thinking, which is what we're focusing on today, abstractions having enormous implications for both cognitive life and emotional life, that emergence occurs quite systematically according to the data. The first level of abstraction emerging at about 10 years of age, the next level at about 15, and the third at about 20, and the fourth at about 25. Single abstractions, abstract mappings, abstract systems, and principles, respectively. That's for optimal level. Recall that that optimal level functioning emerges some years before functional level. An optimal level is assessed with high support. So that emerges at 10, 15, 20, and 25 years for abstract skills. Along with those cognitive changes, there are brain changes going on, and the brain changes indicating reorganization of brain activity occur at about the same ages. Now, there are no powerful tests to show that the brain changes and the cognitive changes really go together, because they haven't been studied in the same people. But there are a number of studies of brain development and of cognitive development that showed the same age-related time course. Here's data from Matusik and Peterson, a study in Sweden, done for medical purposes, looking at electroencephalogram and the power or energy in the EEG wave. You may have seen this curve before. It shows a series of systematic spurts and plateaus. And the first one in puberty occurs at about 11 years with the surge you see in the graph, which corresponds to the age of development of single abstractions. The second one, abstract mappings, at about 15, the same age again, and the third one at about 19, corresponding with the emergence of abstract systems. So The brain changes look like they go with the cognitive changes, and you know, maybe in 10 years we'll know for sure, because the research will have been done to really measure them in the same people. There are new findings happening about brain anatomy, not just brain activity. MRI is allowing us to look at brain anatomy development in living people instead of having to wait for someone to die. And so that has produced, among other findings, clear evidence for anatomical growth spurts in the brain during the ages of puberty. Here's just one example from Geed's work at the NIH, where he finds evidence, he and his colleagues, for a growth spurt in language areas between 9 and 13 in a particular girl that they were studying, as you can see in the graph. So those areas grew in mass, showing a spurt during that age period. Data like these on the anatomical growth of the brain are going to turn out to be an important way of pinning down connections between brain and cognition in development, supporting, going along with, adding to the brain activity data that I was just talking about. Now, this is, I couldn't resist putting in a little humorous event here. A few years ago, somebody walked past one of the big magnets at Mass General Hospital with a metal cart while the magnet was on. There are all kinds of signs saying you're not supposed to do that sort of thing. The metal cart was drawn into the magnet and with great force and rapidity. Unfortunately, the person pushing the cart broke his arm, being caught in there. But he's okay, recovered just fine. And they put this picture up on the web for a while so that all of us would know if we're going into an MRI lab, you have to get rid of any magnetic metal. You can't have it near the MRI machine. But this is an MRI magnet, and this is the metal cart that got sucked into it. So it's a very powerful magnet to produce these MRI effects. Just an aside. Now, in adolescence, there's evidence for growing for a lot of particular changes in the brain, which need to be put together into a portrait of brain change and connected ultimately to our findings about developmental changes in cognition and emotion. One of the most interesting changes, it comes from the findings of Francine Bennis at the McLean Hospital, where she's looked at myelin growth in brains of people who have died in the brain bank there. And she's found a surge in myelin growth in adolescents. You'll recall that myelin is the fatty insulation around axons in neurons, as the figure shows, and that it produces faster neuronal transmission than axons that don't have myelin transmit much more slowly and inefficiently. Between 10 and 17 years, right at the heart of puberty, the myelin on the pathways going from the frontal cortex down into the limbic system doubles. So it really grows fast, producing a much larger, much more effective insulation of the pathways from the frontal cortex to the limbic system, presumably thus increasing the efficiency of connections between frontal and limbic. So that's another one of the brain changes that most likely contributes to a lot of the cognitive changes and emotional changes that we see in adolescents. There's one more measure of brain that I'm going to talk about, and it's another version of the power measure that I was talking about before, where we're looking at how the growth of frontal power, of amount of energy in the frontal area of the brain. And it looks like, from the data that exists, of Hudspeth and Prebrom especially, that frontal power surges when you have the movement into what we call a new tier of development. Abstractions are one of the tiers of development. So when the abstractions are beginning to emerge, there's a surge in frontal power, the amount of energy and waves in the frontal area. This is an example of a diagram of a cycle that's been hypothesized for growth of power moving around the cortex systematically across levels. It includes a frontal power spurt with the beginning of the cycle of levels. And if you look at the data from Hudspeth and Prebrum, you'll see there's evidence for three major power spurts. One with the emergence of representations at about 2 years of age, when children begin to be able to represent things concretely, not just act on them and perceive them. Then at around nine, with the beginning of abstract thinking and the onset of the adrenal sex hormones, there's evidence for a spurt in frontal power. There's a bit more activity in the frontal area in during puberty, but it really surges toward 20 years of age as adolescents, now young adults, are becoming able to build abstract systems that combine lots of concrete representations to be able to think systematically about personality, motivation, ideology, mathematics, scientific reasoning, all kinds of different abstract concepts. So it looks like there are specifically power surges in the frontal area, probably indicating more frontal activity, more frontal contribution to cognitive processes with the emergence of each of the tiers of representations and abstractions, and with the highest levels of abstraction that start developing in the 20s. So an overview of what goes on in the development of abstractions. We focus so far on brain bases that are correlated with the development of abstractions. Now we're going to focus on several examples of the development of abstract concepts math, about knowledge, about oneself in relationships. These new capacities start in before puberty, at around 9 or 10 years of age, but their development goes on into the mid-20s. This is something that Piaget did not know. It's a discovery of the last 30 years that major new conceptual capacities continue to develop into the 20s. When people talk about conceptual change being so important in early childhood, well, the evidence is conceptual change continues to occur in major ways throughout childhood into adolescence and on into adulthood, at least into up to 25 or 28 years. That development of abstractions involves not only the kind of math and science concepts that Piaget was interested in, but how we see ourselves in the world, with other people, within our culture, within our society. So I'm going to focus on a couple of examples. I've listed here four different areas where there's a lot of research. We're going to talk a little bit about math, a little bit about reflective judgment, and about self and relationships. A question that we want to ask first is, how do the concrete representations that children become so good at, how do they become reorganized to form abstractions, initially single abstractions? We'll use an example here of the concept of intention, that you have an intention to carry out a particular action. Now, children have concepts of intention, kind of simple, concrete ones, at a very early age. You see them in their behavior when a baby is reaching out for a rattle or for his mommy's nose. That's a concrete intention in action. But children come to represent intentions beyond the having them in their actions, and eventually they come to represent more than a concrete intention. They come to be able to understand that people can have kind of hidden intentions. This is greatly facilitated by abstract thinking, the idea that intentionality isn't always right out there in front of you. It can be hidden, and then the intention is inferred from coordinating a number of concrete representations that imply a particular abstract intention. So we're also going to talk a little bit about how identifications move into identity. So that'll be outside of class, outside of this video in class. And you can also look at how personalities become built up. We've written some things about that for those of you that are interested. So here is a representation of the development of concrete representations, so a symbolization of that development. You'll remember that in early childhood, children come to be able to represent themselves and other people, for example, as mean or as nice, and that builds up gradually from separate representations to mappings of representations to systems of representations. When they have a system of representations, they can represent themselves and other people in interaction as having several characteristics, like being both of them being nice and mean at the same time, or both of them being a doctor, a patient, a father, a child. What happens with the construction of abstractions is a couple of these representational systems are put together to form an abstraction. We've represented it here with these building blocks, which give you a sense of how complex the abstraction is hidden behind the general idea of, say, intention. You've got a whole bunch of representations in relationship to each other, as the complicated block at the bottom illustrates. So to represent it visually, you take two or more systems of representations. You coordinate those to form this complicated block, which is simplified through the construction of an abstraction, in this case, intention. So in one interaction, the self character, I am nice and mean to somebody else who's based on how they've been nice and mean to me. We have assessments for how people understand nice and mean interactions. And there's a second interaction in which the self is interacting in a nice and mean way with another person. So you've got three people, and the self is interacting with two others, in both cases being nice and mean. That interaction is put together with the idea of an intention, so that you can compare the two interactions to infer what the other person really meant to do, including hidden intentions. So in diagrammatic terms, two of the concrete representational systems are coordinated to form the idea that intentions matter more than actions. We have a specific example here. You probably want to look at it, maybe even print it out and read through it. There's a particular story that spells out this intentions matter more than actions concretely. I'll just describe it briefly. Seth really cares what people mean to do more than what they actually do. So when he's playing with or interacting with Jason and Liam, these are adolescents, so I shouldn't say playing. They're working on puzzles and on homework. Liam says he's got this neat puzzle and he wants Seth to help him with it. But Jason knows that this really isn't a neat puzzle. It's homework that Liam wants Seth to do for him. So Liam is acting like he wants to be a friend and work on this puzzle with Seth, but really what he wants is to get Seth to do his homework for him. So Liam is initially acting nice, but there's a mean intention hidden. Jason, on the other hand, shoves Liam away, initially acting mean, because he knows what's really going on. And so Jason has an overt mean action, which is really in the service of a nice intention, which is to protect Seth from doing something he shouldn't be doing, doing Liam's homework for him, whereas Liam has a nice action, which is really hidden by a mean intention. So what Seth ultimately recognizes is that Liam is really manipulating him with a mean intention, whereas Jason, who appears to be mean, is actually being nice. So intentions matter more than actions, as embodied in these two interactions. The concrete representational systems are coordinated in this way to form abstractions. That is how people build abstractions. And once they get the abstractions, they've got a simpler way of thinking about, of working with the representational systems that are embodied in the abstractions. So the idea of intention is much simpler than having to go through a long description like I just did of the interaction of Liam, Jason, and Seth. You can just say intentions matter more than actions. Jason's kind intention was what was important, in contrast to Liam's mean intention. Have a look at that story, and hopefully it'll all make sense to you to show how the concrete representational systems are combined to form a simplifying concept of intention. That's the building block. That's the beginning for abstractions. We have single abstractions that first emerge at 9, 10, 11, 12 years of age, depending on the domain. Then they are combined into mappings of abstractions. The mappings are combined into systems of abstractions. Those emerge at about 15 and 20 years of age, respectively. And then finally, in the mid-20s, the abstract systems are put together to create broad principles for understanding abstractions, like Darwin's principle of evolution by natural selection, like the golden rule, do unto others as you would have them do unto you. There are a number of broad principles. Most of us only really can deal effectively with a few of them, but most of us are capable of at least a few, using at least a few of these broad principles once we're into our late 20s at least. Example of the development of abstractions from arithmetic, from one of our studies. We looked at how adolescents and young adults understood the basic operations of arithmetic, addition, subtraction, multiplication, and division, and how they related them to each other. So how does addition relate to subtraction? How does multiplication relate to addition? And so forth for the four similar pairs. It doesn't apply to division and addition, or multiplication and subtraction, because those are more complicated in the way they relate to each other. It requires a little bit more complicated level of thinking. So here we're talking about mappings in which addition is related to subtraction. So for example, addition and subtraction are both operations for combining single numbers. In one case, you put them together to get a bigger number. In the other case, you take them apart to get a smaller number. Addition and multiplication are both operations for combining numbers, but in one case, addition, you combine numbers individually to get a larger number. In the other case of multiplication, you combine them in groups to get a larger number. So those are two examples of the kind of broad explanation of how the operations relate to each other. In our assessments, the students also need, of course, to be able to show us how this works in some concrete arithmetic problems, like 5 plus 7 equals 12 and 12 minus 5 equals 7. Doing those concrete problems is much easier than giving an explanation of how they show the relation between addition and subtraction. Many 10-year-olds, for example, can show us The relation in a concrete problem, but not until 15 or 16 do students become able, in general, to describe broadly how addition relates to subtraction and apply it to the particular problems. Many people find this unintuitive, just as with many of Piaget's discoveries, where it seemed like, well, of course, five-year-olds understand conservation of orange juice. But over and over again, people have shown that they don't. And likewise here, adolescents before about 15 have great trouble coordinating two of these operations in an abstract way. Here's an example of the first study we did of this, where the results were very dramatic. With low support assessment shown on the blue line, there's very poor performance all the way from 9 to 20 years of age. This is a cross-sectional study, about 8 students at each age group in Denver, in various school systems in Denver area. And you'll see even at 20, you only have about 30% of the problems correct in college students doing these problems. But when you look under high support assessment, the red line, where they've had a chance to think about the problems for a couple weeks, and then they're given during the assessment, they're given a prototypic good answer, and they're asked to explain it in their own terms. And you see that between 15 and 16 in this sample, you went from no student getting more than one problem correct out of 8 to every student getting most of them correct. Each age, every student got the same procedure, trying to teach them how to give a good answer, showing them a prototype, allowing them to practice it for a couple weeks, bringing them back, showing it again, asking them to provide the answer. At the earlier ages, teaching procedure had no effect, only a very tiny effect for a few kids at 13 and 14 and 15. But at 16, for every student, all of a sudden, that teaching procedure led to a high level of performance. So there's a sudden emergence under these optimal assessment conditions of the understanding of the mapping between addition and subtraction, between addition and multiplication, between division and subtraction, and so forth, at about 16 years of age, showing the spurt in the emergence of abstract mappings. Now, notice in the graph that there's another little spurt out at 20 years of age. You'll remember I said that there's another level that emerges, abstract systems is called, at about 20. Well, here you can see a little bit of a spurt from about 80% right to about 100% right. This has turned up over and over in our research now, that when a new level emerges, the typical jump is not up to 100%. It's often only just maybe 40 or 50 or 60% correct. And then when the next level emerges, you have the performance at the prior level surging forth again. I'll show you another example in a few minutes. So within the math study, you can see it again with another graph. This is a graph for when in the first assessment session the students were given the support, shown the prototypic good answer and asked to explain it, their performance also showed a jump, but it was less dramatic than when they had a couple weeks to practice. So in the pink line, you see a jump that occurs, instead of being all at 16, it occurs between 15 and 17, and it ends up only up at about 65% correct instead of over 80% correct. Then at 20, there's again a spurt up to a higher level. So there's a succession of spurts, even for tasks that are designed to assess just one level. Now, reflective judgment is another example where there's a lot of great data to show these phenomena. And it's a major issue in college and university education, where one of the major goals, especially of a liberal arts education, is to get us to be able to think about different perspectives, not just our own, but other people's ways of seeing the world. When we read a novel, for example, we go into a different world that was created by another person, and we need to understand it from that person's perspective. When we try to understand another culture, we need to understand the culture from the perspective of the people that are living that culture, not judging it from our own culture. Reflective judgment is about understanding how we know things based on the perspectives of the different people who make arguments about what's true and who collect evidence about what's true. It's centrally about the relativity of knowledge. Reflective judgment is a concept formulated by John Dewey to capture what he thought was the way we come to understand the relativity of knowledge. And Karen Kitchener and Patricia King developed this assessment system for looking at how that understanding develops in particular dilemmas. They found a 7-stage developmental sequence, and it turns out from research that's been done after their original formulation that those stages are exactly the same as the levels of skill that we've been talking about. So those 7 stages of reflective judgment are the 7 levels of skill development for representations and abstractions. At the very beginning, as young as 2 years of age, for stage 1, children have an absolute belief about knowledge, that things are either right or wrong. You know, either the news report is correct or it's incorrect. Or the claim that, say, chemical additives are bad for you in food, that's correct or that's incorrect. Eventually, people come to understand that, well, the truth can be more complicated than that. It can be right in some ways and wrong in some ways. So they develop in adolescence the idea of relative knowledge, that knowledge is relative to the viewpoint and the evidence. Within this conception of relative knowledge, the knowledge is not very stable. It changes with viewpoint and with evidence. Eventually, as we move into the stages 6 and 7 of reflective judgment, people come to understand that, yes, truth depends on argument and evidence, but there can be very good arguments and evidence that make something clearly true, always some possibility of revision based on further evidence in the future. But right now, given what we know, this is true. This is what Dewey referred to as reflective judgment. Now, in the appendix to the slides that go with this, there are examples of a couple of the dilemmas for reflective judgment and 4 specific examples for the circled stages there, 2, 4, 6, and 7. Of prototypic good answers for those stages, so you get a sense of what these arguments are like. Here's the general curve for optimal assessment of reflective judgment. At around 16, there's a jump in stage 5 performance in this study, which started with 14-year-olds. Then that drops down a little bit and surges forward again at around 20, 21 with stage 6, and then drops down and levels off, and then it surges forward again at about 25, 26. So the first surge is stage 5, which is abstract mappings. The second one is stage 6, which is abstract systems. The third one, stage 7, which is principles. In this case, the principle of reflective judgment that John Dewey formulated. I'm going to show you a couple of the graphs, not just the summary score, but the individual score for particular tasks and stages. When you look more specifically that way, you can see the learning processes, the growth processes, the micro-developmental processes much more specifically, much more powerfully. The average curve tends to smooth things out. So here we're going to look at the growth for stage 6 reasoning and the growth for stage 5 reasoning, and that's going to show this consolidation process that I was talking about before, where earlier stages become elaborated and consolidated at later stages or levels. So stage 6 for Kitchener and King is the first stage that shows reflective judgment. It's not fully formulated reflective judgment, but it's a long way there. And the basic gist of it is that knowledge is, of course, uncertain based on what evidence and viewpoints people have, but given the current evidence and the current arguments, we can come up with strong, justified conclusions for many areas that go across domains and across viewpoints. So that kind of argument is what people are being asked to make about dilemmas like, are chemical additives to food good for you or bad for you? You know, chemical additives, for example, that prevent the food from getting rotten, keep you from getting food poisoning, but some of them may also cause other diseases like cancer. So are chemical additives to food good for you or bad for you? Do they make you healthy or make you ill? For stage 6 explanations for that and other dilemmas, in this study that we did, Kitchener and Lynch and me and some other people, we found that for ordinary performance, where you just interview people about these dilemmas and you just ask them to explain what they think, that's low level, low support, functional level, you get slow, gradual improvement. You get hardly any responses reflecting stage 6 until about 22 or 23, and then it increases a little bit and levels off at around 40% out into the late 20s. When you look under optimal conditions for stage 6 explanations, you see instead a series of jumps, a tiny one at 17, which is not statistically reliable, and then a clear one at 20 and toward 21, and another one out at 25, 26. Those are stage 6 and stage 7. You'll notice for the stage 6 one that only half of the answers show stage 6 explanations at 20 for this spurt at 20 and 21 years of age. So there's a clear jump in understanding of stage 6 arguments about chemical additives and other dilemmas, but it only gets up to about half of the answers showing stage 6. So people at this age are capable of stage 6, but they can't do it consistently. They do it about half the time. Then a few years later, when they're now at the age when stage 7 emerges, in other words, the age of principles, the last level of abstract development, they now show nearly 100% stage 6 performance. So the stage 6 explanations surge to become predominant. Now they have become the consolidated understanding. So when you're at a level, what does that mean? It can mean that you're capable of it under the best circumstances, or it can mean it's the way you reason most easily and most generally, and those are different. For 25-year-olds in this study, there's another graph which shows that they are capable of stage 7 30, 40, 50% of the time, but what they can do consistently all the time is stage 6. Now, show you the graph for stage 5, which shows the same kind of consolidation process. Knowledge, the argument here is knowledge is relative to context or viewpoint, and so it's uncertain. And for stage 5, there's a belief that conclusions have to be justified within the context or viewpoint. There's a lot of difficulty seeing consistency across contexts and viewpoints. You remember stage 6, you could have a consistent argument for what's true across contexts and viewpoints, but at stage 5, it tends to shift with context and viewpoint. That's a little easier to do, and it develops about 5 years earlier. So for stage 5 explanations, we see the first surge up to 40 or 50% correct at 15 or 16 years. We see that's stage 5. Then we see at the age for stage 6, we see a surge in stage 5 explanations up to over 80% correct. And then at the age for stage 7, we see it going up to 100%, nearly 100%. So, again, for this, now this is a different task. It's assessing a stage 5 explanation, not a stage 6 explanation, but it shows the same pattern as the stage 6 explanation, that when a skill first emerges, a level of understanding first emerges, the adolescents can use it in some tasks when they're given high support, but they can't use it consistently. The ability to use it consistently emerges later on with further spurts, with the emergence of later levels of development. This, of course, is an important principle for thinking about assessment, for thinking about education, that somebody doesn't simply get something at a certain age and then have it. It requires a lot of work to be able to construct it, to consolidate it, to generalize it, and that takes years and shows a systematic progression. So the implications for this are that a type of skill develops one or more levels before it becomes predominant in thinking and reasoning and arguing and understanding, and that when it becomes very common, the person's maximal capacity is actually beyond it. They can do much more complicated arguments, but they can't do them as consistently. So a thought question for everybody, something we can't answer at this point, is what does that imply about brain reorganizations? If these brain reorganizations are occurring at ages in parallel with the cognitive reorganizations, then maybe this evidence for a kind of continuing cognitive reorganization and consolidation has some kind of implications for how to think about the brain reorganization. So another domain and method, Theo Dawson's study of moral judgment using Roche scaling. Roche scaling is a method that's widely used in psychological testing now, which is based on the assumption that that skill grows in a logistic form, not in a linear form. And this scaling turns out to have great properties for creating tests. And for assessing the properties of the scales underlying tests. In this case, we've got a developmental complexity scale, so it's a perfect situation for using Roche analysis. And it turns out from this moral judgment study that Dawson did and a number of other studies that she and other people have done that Roche scaling shows gaps that go precisely with the kinds of changes we were just talking about in terms of spurts in performance. So where there's a spurt in performance to show the emergence of a mapping, there's a gap in the Roche scaling, even when with other kinds of assessment tools, not the ones that we were using for looking at optimal level. And so I'll show you some of those data. And also, an important point is that in these data, she's been able to look at what are the strongest correlates of the high levels of abstract reasoning in adults. And it turns out that education is much more important than age during adulthood. So people with higher levels of education are more likely to show higher levels of abstract skill. Here's an example of one of her Logit graphs. You'll see the skill level as shown by the Logit is the unit on the log scale that comes out of Roche analysis, and you'll see there are little jumps at a number of places, but there are points where they're kind of extended plateaus. Those are the places when the full level is present in the person's interview performance, and when you plot this not just in terms of logits, but you add the probability of a person's responding based on the Rosh analysis, you get a nice series of jumps in performance for each of the levels. So it's exactly the kind of waves of new skill that we found in the arithmetic study and in the reflective judgment study. Now, people show big changes in their concepts of self and others during adolescence as well. And for most adolescents, that's much more interesting to them than this stuff about reflective judgment or moral judgment, right? What's really interesting is, who am I, and who are my friends, and how do we connect to each other, and who are my parents, and do I love them or hate them, and all that kind of stuff. So in childhood, children represent other people and themselves in mostly concrete terms. So who am I? Well, I'm the kid with red hair and freckles, and I like to play baseball, right? Whereas in adolescence, it becomes more abstract. Who am I? Well, I'm the kid who's really good at math, but who hates writing. Or I'm the kid who is kind of introverted, I'm uncomfortable in novel circumstances. Or I'm the kid who wants to hide what I'm really thinking so other people don't know. So it becomes much more internal, much more abstract. The Self and Relationships interview is designed to assess this development in adolescence and the concrete development before it in childhood, where people construct their own diagrams of what they're like in important relationships. It's done under low support and high support assessments. We're going to talk mostly about the high support. And it assesses cognitive levels. In some of my other video chapters, I talk about this tool for looking at emotions, for looking at the content of relationships, but it also is a very effective tool for looking at cognitive levels. We've used it in four different countries: Korea, China, Taiwan, and the U.S. I'm going to give an example from Korea and an example from China. So this is a Korean girl of 15 who encounters this circle diagram with most important things to be put in the middle, least important things to be put on the outside, as she constructs a diagram of herself in relationships. First, she describes what she's like with her best friend, with her father, with her mother, the roles that you see in the lower right-hand corner. Those descriptions are written down on little post-its with glue on the back of them, and then they are put into the diagram and then grouped and related. So you'll see she says that she's attentive in school, she's cheerful in the real me, she's honest with her best friend, she's awkward with her romantic friend, she's fun with her sibling, and so forth. Those are descriptions that she makes that are written down on the piece of paper. And then she groups these into groups that go together by her way of thinking about herself in relationships. And then she draws lines between them if they have particular relationships of similarity or opposition or conflict. So you see, for example, she sees herself as feeling estranged and inferior with her sibling, but cheerful in the real me, the one marked C up there with a little arrow, and she sees that those two constructions as in conflict with each other. That's an example then of a relation between abstractions, a mapping or a system, depending upon how much she elaborates it. When we use this kind of tool to analyze complexity in a bunch of adolescents in Seoul, Korea, we found under ordinary assessment conditions, where we just ask them to describe what they're like in their important relationships, and we don't have them build this supportive diagram, then we find that all the adolescents, even out into college age, give almost only concrete self-descriptions. They seem to not have an abstract self-concept. In fact, there's some stuff in the literature that says Asian adolescents don't have abstract self-concepts. So when you just ask them like that, that's what they show. They show concrete self-concepts, not abstract ones. But when you use the self and relationships interview, you get a very different portrait with the youngest adolescents in this sample in eighth grade clearly showing abstract concepts about what they're like in their important relationships. And that's showing quite a substantial increase with time, with a surge at about 11th grade with the emergence of mappings, and another surge at 13th grade with the emergence of abstract systems. Notice that with the one in the middle, when they're seeing mappings, there's a big increase in both Korea and in the U.S. in the amount of conflict that people, that these adolescents perceive in their own personalities or their own self and relationships. For Koreans, one of the most significant conflicts was a public-private conflict, that they felt that they were only their real selves when they were with their mom or their best friend, and with other people, they were putting forward often this public self, which they didn't feel was real. And so a whole lot of them described that as a major conflict. Notice also that in the oldest group, at about age 20, there's a much bigger gap between optimal and functional level than there is in the youngest group. So there's an increasing gap between the optimal and functional skill with age. And this goes across many different studies that we've done. It looks like with age, contrary to what Vygotsky might predict, it's not true that the gap between the highest we can do with support and our ordinary performance gets less. It seems to actually get larger, at least through the late 20s. Now here's an example from China. Yankin Wang did this study in Suzhou, and she was looking at adolescents' conceptions of themselves in relationships in terms of self-conscious emotions, things like shame and respect and honor and pride. Here's one actual diagram that an adolescent girl put together. She was 17. Here we've translated it into English. You'll see she sees herself at the core, most important, that she's relaxed and composed with her mother and father and sibling. And she's also composed and relaxed with her teacher and her classmates. And she sees those as similar to each other. So she draws a line between them with the letter, with a number 5 there. She also sees herself as tense with another friend and with one of her other teachers. Over on the right-hand side of the diagram, marked D, she sees that as in conflict with this relaxed, composed self. A clear case of at least a mapping of abstractions. So in both the Korean study and the Chinese study, we see this development of mappings in adolescents about self and relationships, about personality and motivation. Here's the graph for the self-conscious emotions, the levels in China. Functional level was quite low, just as in Korea. A little bit of steeper growth than in Korea, but still remaining quite concrete, not very much evidence of abstractions even out to age 18. But when we look at high support with the diagram that they built for themselves to support their own explanations and descriptions, we see abstractions already clearly present at 13 and a surge towards mappings at 16. So across these three cultures, we find in the U.S., in China, in Korea, all single abstractions emerging at about age 10, abstract mappings emerging at about age 15 or 16, And in some of the studies, not in this one, further evidence for abstract systems emerging at about age 20. So there's clear development of abstractions by multiple measures in multiple cultures that's tied to age when you look at optimal level, with abstractions emerging at about 10 and 15 and 20 and 25 years of age. There may be development beyond that. Everybody always wants there to be further development because we don't want to stop developing. There are several people in the literature who insist, well, the principles cannot be the end. There has to be development beyond that. And maybe there is, maybe there isn't. I think that'd be wonderful, but we have to have empirical evidence for it. So in terms of the cognitive evidence, there's not yet any evidence for another level emerging beyond the one that jumps out at about 25. There is evidence for something else going on in the brain at a later age, which is quite interesting, and I'll just present that as an intriguing finding. But I don't think even if the last level emerges at age 25, it's not all over. It's really tough to use and understand abstract principles. It's even tough to use and understand abstract systems. It takes years to become an expert at it. So even if our highest capacity emerges at 25 and we don't develop any further new capacities connected to brain functioning beyond that, then still we've got a lot to do, because the capacities that we have are so powerful and take so much work to be able to use skillfully. Still, there's this evidence that I mentioned, the intriguing evidence, again from Francine Bennis, from her myelination study. She has found evidence that myelin not only spurts in adolescence, as we talked about before, myelin for connections between the frontal and the limbic system. Again, she looked through the whole brain, but she's found particular evidence for the myelin growing for frontal limbic connections in adolescence and then again in the 40s and 50s. So in the 40s and 50s, there's a further increase in the myelination of the axons going from the limbic system going from the prefrontal cortex down into the limbic system. Interestingly, it's actually larger for males than for females in her sample. But before everybody, all the males in the audience start cheering, the reason for that seems to be that the level of myelin in the males is lower than it is in the females in the 30s. So it's like the males are catching up to the females. But both males and females show this evidence for a spurt in myelin connecting frontal and limbic systems in the 40s and 50s. Bennis speculates that maybe this has something to do with what our culture calls wisdom. Overview then for what we've talked about. Cognitive development goes way beyond childhood. Capacity to build abstractions begins in late childhood at around 9 or 10 years of age, around the time that the precursors of puberty are starting. The first single abstractions develop, and children can build many single abstractions at about 10 or 12 years of age, at least in the cultures that we've studied. That capacity then continues to develop with new abilities to coordinate abstractions, emerging at about 15 for mapping them, relating them in simple ways, at about 20 for building them in more complicated systems, interrelating them, and then at about 25 for being able to put them together in terms of principles to explain and coordinate relations among many abstractions. This process extends across math, science, philosophy, as in epistemology, morality, self-description, understanding of political concepts, understanding of just about everything. So these capacities emerge during adolescence and early adulthood. They're very powerful. They allow us to be able to connect similarities across and differences across very widely divergent domains, and it's a gradual process. So when we've developed a new capacity, it's not all of a sudden there. It takes years for us to consolidate it, and our most sophisticated reasoning, at least in adolescence and early adulthood, is always ahead of where we can readily and easily reason. So this has great implications for a whole lot of things about development. I think one of the most powerful implications is that we develop a need in starting in puberty for figuring out who we are in the bigger picture of things. We develop ideology. We develop a broad sense of who we are as a personality, who our friends are as personalities. We develop meaning for our lives, not just contextualized in our house with our family, but a broader meaning of how we fit into the whole big picture of things in the world. And that process is centrally driven by the development of abstractions.